But what is called the American Dream, we don't hear much of that anymore, but we did years ago. The American Dream is a matter of trust, isn't it? Trust that the government would place as few encumbrances as necessary upon the people and commerce. Trust that business would deal fairly and honestly with employees and customers. Trust, quite frankly, that the nation had a destiny from God. One of the great tragedies of the time in which we live, I believe, is the erosion of trust. Contracts are now made to be broken in business. Prenuptials are more and more common before people marry. Spy software for computers is a growing market, and even surveillance systems for homes that used to be very rare are now very commonplace. Trust in our local officials or elected officials have been seriously damaged to the point that just about the only time people believe a politician is when they're painting a picture of bad news. Even trust, sadly, in religious organizations have been eroded with scandals running the spectrum across many denominations. In fact, what happened in this country 10 or so years back with the Catholic Church has now come to the European continent, and they're facing the wrath of people over there. How about us? Those of us sitting here today, what do we trust in? Has our trust been weakened along with the world around us? Think about it. We can't function physically or spiritually without trust. We have to trust the engineer that designed the bridge we drive across. We see that with the interchanges down in Milwaukee, right? They let those go too long. We have to trust the airplanes we fly in. I'm still not quite there 100%. I always get the willies, but especially when they take off. We have to trust the elevator we ride in. We have to trust, and the list goes on, right? The things that we have to trust. We would be paralyzed with fear and uncertainty if we didn't trust. In fact, there are people that live that way, don't they? They can't go out of their homes. They can't go on trips. They can't do a lot of things because their phobias are simply a lack of trust expanded. The same is true for us spiritually. We must trust in God as a child should learn to trust a parent. The way it should be. In spiritual terms, this is oftentimes referred to as faith. But that concept, quite frankly, is rather nebulous to us, isn't it? It's rather abstract. Faith, spiritually speaking, does involve trust. Trust that God will do what he has promised. Trust that he can control events or trials or circumstances that we cannot. And even in the matter of considering sin, we must trust that God will forgive us, that he will strengthen us to cease from that sin, that he is faithful of his promises and on. Today I'm going to touch on this subject of trust in God and how we can see it has worked in the lives of others and how we can develop that trust more fully in our lives. I'd like to begin today with the example in Exodus 14. We can often look at many of these examples and consider in hindsight that we would have done them much better, but quite frankly, I think that's not the case. When we see how things shape out after the fact, we have the luxury of knowing everything, don't we? And yet, as the children of Israel approached the Red Sea, not only was that a completely new circumstance, but just how God interacted with them was something they had never experienced in the past. In Exodus chapter 14 and verse 10, we read, Pharaoh drew near. This is as the children of Israel are leaving. They'd gone out with a high hand. The plagues are done. The first Passover has taken place. They had spoiled the Egyptians, and Pharaoh basically threw them out of the country, and then waking up later, realized they were letting the best thing they ever had go. And so Pharaoh goes out after them. The children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Any of us that wouldn't do that? You see an army pursuing you, it would have to be overwhelming. They had the best of thoughts, of hopes for the future, and now suddenly it looks like it's all going to be squashed. Verse 11, they said to Moses, notice how quickly their attitude changes here. Because there were no graves in Egypt, And how long had they been in Egypt? 400 plus years? They're being a little disingenuous here, aren't they? But it's easy to pin a problem on one person, isn't it? Somebody else especially. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? We missed that part of the story, didn't we? Maybe that's a little bit of revisionist history going on there. Maybe they did say it. I don't know. I rather suspect not. Notice what Moses says, though, in verse 13. Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you will not see again ever. Easy to say, isn't it? How many do you think really believe that? That saw that as something, a matter of trust they could hang their hat on, so to speak. Notice he goes on in verse 14, the Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace. In other words, Moses is pleading with the people, don't be afraid. Stand firm and you will see God's deliverance for you. In other words, trust in God. Remember what they just went through. We rehearsed this many times during around the Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread. They had seen those plagues. Three of them they'd gone through with the Egyptians. The last seven, I wouldn't want to be out in the field when those hailstones were coming down. I wouldn't have wanted to grope around in the dark. Don't know if you've ever experienced that. I've gone in caves before. You turn the lights out, you can't see a thing. Groping around like that? And then the death of the firstborn. They saw all of these things, and yet they're still hesitant, aren't they? Here's some definitions of trust. Faith or confidence, to depend upon, to commit to a person's care, to put in charge of, to do something without fear of the outcome. Trust. Let's notice next Isaiah 57, what God says to us. The interesting thing to sort of hold in the back of your mind as we read through and cover this material today is what God says he will do when we have that trust. It's not, as we say it with faith even, it is not just blind trust, is it? It's not just blind faith. God's not asking us to do things without any understanding, without any appreciation of the outcome. We may not have all the information initially, but he does include us in the process, doesn't he? In Isaiah 57 and in verse 13, he says to them, when you cry out, let your collection of idols deliver you. One of the things that he forever dealt with through his prophets to the nation of Israel was the violation of the worship, what they were to trust in. And once again, through Isaiah, he's saying, look, when things don't go well, try crying out to your idols and see what they do. For the wind will carry them all away and the breath will take them, but he who trusts in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. Now remember, this is not just God talking on a physical level. There is the promise of the inheritance of the land, but what's more important? In the Bible, one of the symbols of a mountain is a government. That what God is promising as well is a participation in his government, to be part of his family as we understand it. Verse 14, and one shall say, heap it up, prepare the way, take the stumbling block out of the way of my people. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, with him who has a contrite and humble spirit. I am convinced one of the greatest shames of our modern culture all around the globe is the breaking of trust between the generations. I mean, look at where our schools are. We can't even in some areas of the country trust our teachers with our children, can we? We're not even sure who to trust in terms of authority. It used to be, at least when I was a boy, they would tell you, if you get lost, if you get turned around, if you get in trouble, find a policeman. I don't know that I would give that same advice today. I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, like a child when they're young. That trusting nature to revive the heart of the contrite ones. That God seeks that trust because he knows where it will lead to. For us, for him, and the family that he desires. And this is something that he's forever patient with. And Joshua chapter 1, we find the interesting story of Joshua as he takes over the mantle of leadership from Moses. If you remember the story, God had told Moses that he could not go into the promised land because of what he did with the incident at the rock, how he struck it, how he rebuked the people in a way that God did not tell him to do. And so Moses has died. Joshua has taken over. In verse 1, the death of Moses, the servant of the Eternal, came to pass that the Eternal spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am given to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread, I have given it to you. As I said to Moses, from the wilderness of this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, to the great sea, going towards towards the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. All that they could imagine at the time. No man will be able to stand before you, and that all the days of your life, as I was with Moses, I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. That's a promise, I believe it was Peter that quoted. I will not leave you or forsake you. Verse 6, notice, be strong and of a good courage. Trust in what I say to you. Trust in what I do through you. Trust in me, as we read earlier. Be strong and very courageous that you may observe to do all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Don't turn away from the right hand or the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. Do an interesting exercise sometime on your own and go through just the first two chapters and notice how many times he says to Joshua, be strong and courageous. God is patient with us in these things. It's not that he says you need to do this and then gets angry when we don't. It's hard, isn't it? As it was with the children of Israel. You know, for Moses to stand up there and say, wait, just be patient. God will deal with it. And how many do you think were saying under their breath, yeah, right. This isn't going to go very well. But we do the same thing, don't we? All too often, unfortunately. We have many other examples in Scripture. Let's just turn briefly and look at one in 1 Samuel chapter 25. David certainly led an interesting life, very colorful stories. Didn't always do the right thing. Actually had some major character aspects that he needed to deal with, didn't he? And yet he was always receptive when God directed him. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, we have here in this chapter the story of Nabal. Nabal's an interesting story. David here had been wandering because he was fleeing from Saul. Samuel dies in verse 1. The Israelites gathered together and lamented for him, buried it at his home in Ramah. David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now there was there, it said, a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal. Now, scholars have speculated as to whether this was really his name. Because if you look it up, his name means fool. I'm sure glad my parents didn't name me that, even if I act that way sometimes. So the stage is set. We are introduced to Nabal, and says the name of his wife was Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding, beautiful appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent his 10 younger men and said to them, go to Carmel, go to Nabal, greet him in my name. Thus you say to him, who lives in prosperity, peace be with you, peace to your house, peace at all you have. Now I've heard that you have shearers, your shepherds are with us. And we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Now, one of the things that David did in these wanderings was he, in essence, became a security force for those on the fringes. And many times they would be at the whims of the marauders. And David provided a service. And he's reminding Nabal here, I help protect your property. Can you provide us some supplies? And notice what happens here. Nabal does not treat the young men well. Verse 9, the young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David, and they waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? Who does this guy think he is? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away from one each from his master. Well, this is just another one of these rebels running around the country. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men that I don't know where they're from? Now, he's not being not only nice here, he's not even being respectful. He's deliberately forgetting all that David had done to help protect him. So David's young men turned away, went back to David, and told him all these words. And then David, notice his reaction. I often wondered how long it took to get that head of steam up. Bible doesn't say, but very next description is, every man girded on his sword. David was going to go deal with this in a way that he understood very directly. So they did. Notice, 400 men. He wasn't playing around here either. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he has reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything, as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. The servants know this. They know that they were protected. Verse 18, Abigail then made haste, took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 sheahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Now remember, David's got 400 at least men. That sounds like a huge feast, and it is in many ways. But Abigail also knew what David was capable of and how wrong her husband was. She says to her servants, go before me, see, I'm coming after you, but she did not tell her husband Nabal. Now, I'll leave the story off there. You can continue it on your own. We know the rest of it is that she met David. She pleaded for her husband's life. He relented, saw her wisdom, and God dealt with Nabal. He died shortly after this. Trust. Who do we trust in? Who did Abigail trust in? She didn't trust David. She knew what David could do. She knew how he helped protect their property. She certainly didn't trust in her husband. She pleaded for his life, but knew how foolishly he was dealing with the situation. David, to his credit, in this situation, did trust God. He knew that it would be taken care of in some fashion. Who do we trust in? Are we like Nabal, trusting in our own riches? There are a lot of people that trusted in riches that don't have much now, do they? They trusted in a particular job that they may not have now either. But they trusted in the government to take care of things. And more often than not, we're disappointed in those things because they can't. As we read in Isaiah 57, those idols, those physical things cannot help us, can they? They can be a means to an end on a temporary basis to take care of us, to provide for us the things that we need in order to live and help serve God and each other. But they're only temporary. Whom do we trust in? I'll tell you a little story from my past, something that still resonates with me to this day, because it speaks to this matter of trust. When I was 16, as most 16-year-old boys want to do, I needed a driver's license. And the way to do it, and to do it cheap enough for me to afford, was to take driver's education at school, because you could get the discount on your insurance if you did that. The high school instructor for the course was also the phys ed teacher. And he was a tough guy. Didn't want to cut you much slack, especially if you weren't on one of the sports teams he coached. Not known for being very accommodating. The students who took the course were assigned in groups of four, so that one would be driving, he'd be the other one in the front, working the pedals when they didn't do the right thing, and three others in the back, ostensibly to be observing. I signed up to take the course, waited to see what group I would be with, and when the assignments were posted, my heart sank. Because the driving part of the course was all done on Saturday. I knew I couldn't do that. Worse yet, I knew I had to tell the instructor I couldn't do that. I talked to my parents first, I think more to screw up my own courage than to really ask them what needed to be done. I did go tell the instructor. True to my fear, he told me that I couldn't take the course. I couldn't be there on Saturday, I couldn't take it. And I was devastated. What was I going to do now? It meant that I'd have to wait probably a couple of years to get my license. If I didn't take the course, I couldn't get the discount on the insurance. Without that discount, I couldn't afford to drive. And as I mentioned, what 16-year-old doesn't want to drive? I resigned myself to that bleak prospect of my parents driving me everywhere I needed to go. And then something interesting happened. This was during spring break. And so I was home. I don't even remember what I was doing. Something around the house. Phone call comes through, and they tell me that it's for me. And it's from the school. And I'm thinking, what kind of trouble can I get on spring break from the school? So I took the call. It was the phys ed teacher, the driving instructor, asking me if I would be interested in taking the course if the driving portion was on Sunday. Now, lest you think he was magnanimous, I did say yes, and I couldn't believe he was doing it, but the reason was that there were a number of students on the football team who, because of the schedule, couldn't take the driving course on Saturday, and there was an open slot for someone else to be with them on Sunday. What impressed me the most about that incident was the fact that God can even work things out for a 16-year-old in his church. That was one of the things that began me thinking about this way of life. When I had given up, God came through. I had prayed about it, but quite honestly, I didn't know what God would do about it or if he would do anything about it. What I thought was an impossible situation, God made possible. I firmly believe that that helped set the stage for where I am today. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, and in verse 13, the general context here is Paul talking about walking in unity, and he's touching on spiritual gifts as well. And to sort of break into the thought here, in verse 13, he says, until we all come to the unity of faith, that is, that we should be unified, we should use the gifts that God gives us for the reason of being unified in faith, God's faith, to the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, that is, a mature man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Now, we touched on the word trust earlier. What about the word faith? The word faith here has to do with persuasion, credibility, conviction. Are we persuaded that we can trust God? Are we convicted that we can follow His way of life with blessings? Do we have reliance upon Him? That trust. I have another story for you. This is from another individual, not in this area. I found her story very interesting. She said, my father heard about the church, studied the Bible, and got baptized in 1971. Before his encounter with the church, he was born and raised an animist. An animist is someone who believes in the existence of individual spirits in natural objects, trees, rocks, whatever. She said he was raised an animist until he started going to school. Back then, the schools were run by Catholic missionaries, and the curriculum greatly revolved around the Catholic doctrines. He converted to Catholicism when he was a teenager and became very active in the Catholic Church. He met my mother, they got married, they started a family. They were devout Catholics, and their first two children born were baptized in that faith. They were a happy family. Both of them had been to school, and they were holding salary-paying jobs. He was an elementary school teacher, she was a clerk in a big bank. They'd moved back to the capital city, owned a home, and led the kind of life that was considered very successful by Western standards. By the time he'd heard of the Church of God, his career was booming. Teaching was then the best field any man could dream of getting into. Yet, convinced of the truth, he started making changes in his life, changes that would bring many hardships and a lot of pain. In human terms, he couldn't remain affiliated with the Catholic Church. He had to study the Bible for himself, and he wanted to observe the Sabbath, but schools were open on Saturday. He wanted to pay tithe. He struggled with the holy days, wanting to keep them as well, which meant he couldn't commemorate the days that he used to keep as a Catholic. By the time all of this was taking place, he and my mother had three children, and I was born a year after he got baptized. Many things happened as a result of his conversion. He lost his teaching job, and he had to find another way to support us. He lost his relationship with his family because they wouldn't accept that he'd refused to live like them and couldn't partake in their celebrations anymore. On top of everything, he was about to lose his wife because she didn't understand him anymore. He wasn't the man she married and was unhappy with all of this negative attention and publicity that was once on their happy family. My father succeeded in building this relationship with God against everything and everyone, and God is faithful. Just as the case with Job in the Bible, God abundantly restored everything my father lost in the process of becoming his servant and child. He gained a higher paying job at a bank that would grant him anything his faith required from him just so he would work there. His wife decided to stay with him. She writes, ironically, after talking with the local priest. He gained brothers and sisters and friends in God's family. No one in our family ever got seriously sick. Our family never got affected either by the scarcity of crops or food, by the rising prices of things. We would always have enough food, medication, money for ourselves, and more. Excess that my father made sure we shared with the less fortunate people. When I grew old enough to understand what was going on, I could never figure out how we never lacked for anything, no matter how difficult it was for everyone else without exception. Now it's different. I know that God has protected us from so much because my father completely trusted God. Now you might have caught it, you might not have caught it, but that was from someone who didn't live in this country, didn't grow up in this country. We forget sometimes what it's like living outside of this country. How hard things can be on a physical level. She understood that, and yet she saw the trust in her father, how he trusted God for these things. Hebrews 13, verse 5, is one of those scriptures that we should, spiritually speaking, be able to rely upon. A staff when we're weary. A support when we need it. A reminder of encouragement. A prod to keep moving forward. Hebrews 13, verse 5, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. Because the trust in physical things never satisfies, does it? There's always something more, something newer, something better, something flashier. I saw a picture this morning in England. They're lined up around the corners at the stores looking to buy the Apple iTouch. Or iPad, sorry, the iPad. The latest thing to have, and it may be a wonderful product. And I'm not dismissing it, I'm just saying when we trust in those physical things, they're limited. To continue here, as he quotes here, Paul writing in Hebrews 13, as he quotes from what we read earlier in Joshua, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Do we trust in that? Do we really trust in that? To know that God will take care of us. And it might seem in the midst of something very unsettling in our lives, whatever it happens to be, that maybe God has left us. There are mountains on both sides and there's a huge army chasing us and there's water in front of us. And what are we going to do? Do we trust in God to take care of us? In Nahum chapter 1, we don't often turn to some of these books, but there are gems in them. And I always, I laugh at myself because I still have to say it. Hosea, Joel, Amos, you know, I have to walk through them all. Okay, there it is. Nahum. Nahum chapter 1 and then verse 2. God is jealous and the Lord avenges. The Lord avenges and is furious. And he will take his vengeance on his adversaries and he reserves wrath for them. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power and will not at all acquit the wicked. Now, this can seem distant at times, though, can't it? We're especially in this day and age, we're a culture of instant gratification. You know, we don't even have to get out of our cars to get our prescriptions, go to the bank, any number of things. God says here, though, he doesn't forget. Do we trust in that? That ultimately it will be made right. Verse 4. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The flower of Lebanon wilts. The mountains quake before him. The hills melt. The earth heaves at his presence. Yes, the world and all who dwell in it. Who can stand before his indignation? And who can endure the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and rocks are thrown down by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. Notice the contrast. It's not that God is a God that is just capricious. You don't want to get on his bad side, like that phys ed instructor I had. You know, if you're not on his team, he's against you. No, what it's mentioning is when you live a life in opposition to God, he remembers. And when we live a life in harmony with his instruction, he remembers. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, something to trust in. It's always interesting to me what people run to when life becomes uncertain. When we start losing jobs or homes or the things that we trusted in, whatever those happen to be. As we continue here in verse 8, but with an overflowing flood, he will make an utter end of its place, and darkness will pursue his enemies. We trust in God in part to know, because we know, that he will take care of things. Ultimately, he will set it right, that he will restore things, that we have the power of God behind us. As a 16-year-old boy, that astounded me. And that wasn't the only circumstance. There were times when I prayed to God for other items as well, other things in my life. There were times even that I prayed for someone else. I still remember this young boy in one of the other congregations in Cincinnati. Very serious illness, medical problem. I think I've related this before. I remember praying very fervently for that young boy because I could relate. He was my age. And I'm convinced that he was not healed because of my prayers. But it still sets in motion something, doesn't it? I was still part of it, even if it wasn't just my prayers, that God was listening to me along with everyone else. And it still puts us in the right place, doesn't it? To remember whom we should trust on and why and what that brings. And that applies to all of us, whether we're 2 or 92. Does that ever end? Does that trust ever end? Is it never necessary? Romans chapter 8. It shouldn't. To answer the question, it should never go away. In fact, it should always be strengthened. We should see it growing in our lives. And it's not a cop-out that we say to God as we get in the car, protect me as I drive to wherever it is we're driving that day. I've seen enough stupid people on the road that I don't take that lightly. One of the things that still astounds me, unfortunately I don't see it here much in Wisconsin, but in New England I could never get used to this. Be driving down the highway and suddenly somebody from the high-speed lane would hit the exit. Across three lanes, like suddenly they woke up and, oh yeah, this is my exit. And it just astounded me. I never saw anybody get hit. So just be careful if you go to New England, because that's typical, the way they drive. You know, I've seen some pretty horrific things. Do we trust in God for these things? And again, it's not that we should have a fear, but that we know, like when we cross the bridge, I can't change what the engineer did or didn't do. When I fly on the airplane, I can't change what that pilot's going to do or not do. But I have something better behind me. You have something better behind you, don't you? And we can ask God for that protection. We can trust in God for our lives. In Romans 8 and verse 10, Paul here talking about being free from the sin that so easily ensnares us. And Romans 8 verse 10 says, "And if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of that sin, but the spirit is life because of righteousness." That we can trust in that. I know there are people who struggle, quite frankly, that when they go before God and ask for forgiveness of sin, whatever it is, they're not really sure that that's happened. That's not a good place to be. Because we end up defeating the sacrifice of Christ, don't we? That we can even trust in that, as it says here, that we may be dead in the flesh, but the Spirit of God is living in us. That should change everything. Everything that we trust in, everything we believe in, everything that we do. And we should never take it for granted. Please don't misunderstand. But that we can have confidence in that. We can have confidence that God is working in our lives. And that as with Joshua in those first two chapters, He will patiently say to us, be strong and of courage. Be strong and of courage. And if it takes the rest of our lives to overcome something, if we're working on that, what does it matter to God? But if we give up, then we're with those people in Nahum. And God says, I'll remember the things they don't do right. In my introduction, I asked the question, what do you trust in? We've only briefly looked at that today. I would encourage you to do your own study. Consider what promises you can claim before God. The Bible is full of them. The trust that we can have in Him and how oftentimes He came through when it seemed like He would not. We have the stories of David and Daniel and Noah and many other faithful men and women. That what may or may not happen in this physical life will be eclipsed by what is in store for us as spirit beings. It all revolves around the trust we have in God to perform His works. I'd like to conclude in Joshua chapter 24. We were there earlier in the book. Let's go to the end of that book this time. Because we are witnesses to God working in the lives of mankind. Indirectly right now, with them, directly with us, but we will be there. When God removes that veil, when He removes Satan, when He begins to work with mankind directly, we're witnesses to God's promises and His blessings in the meantime to them. Joshua chapter 24, and in verse 14, Joshua is near the end of his life. And any leader, instructor, I'm sure there's always a bit of a hesitancy to know how the next generation is going to do. And he's a little concerned here, but he passes on his encouragement. Joshua 24 and verse 14. Now, therefore, fear God, serve Him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Eternal. And if it seems evil to serve God, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve. That's the instruction in Revelation 3 to Laodicea, isn't it? Don't waffle. Pick one. Do what's right and live it, or don't. Don't play the middle ground. He says, choose. Whether it's the gods your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but notice, he doesn't leave them without a clear understanding. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal. Joshua knew who he trusted in. Joshua lived the life that God encouraged him in chapter 1 and 2, to be strong and courageous. And we've just briefly touched on this today. It's an interesting question to ponder, not just on any given Sabbath, but as we move forward in our calling. Whom do you trust in?